Riley walking the line. Nylander down low. Quick shot. Richie stopped by Hart in that bumper spot. A pretty good look. And now feeds it. Nylander scores. Power play goal. William Nylander from Nick Richie, who has his first leap point.
Welcome back to the program. Welcome to Hour 2 of the Jeff Merrick Show. Hal Gill, by the way, had to bail at the bottom of the hour. We'll look to get him back on another program as soon as possible. In the meantime, you just heard from Chris Cuthbert. The Maple Leafs beat the Philadelphia Flyers yesterday. Front and center, Jack Campbell, who was outstanding as well. William Nylander with a pair of goals and probably could have had a hat trick in this one as well. And from a TV standpoint, front and center yesterday, now from the NHL on SportsCenter, good friend Craig McTavish, who joins me on the Merrick Show. Craig, first of all, thanks so much for stopping by. How was your Wednesday night hockey experience yesterday with Carolyn and Stewie?
Oh, those guys are really real pros, Jeff, as you know. They made it easy. The host, I've had the pleasure of working with James Duffy a number of years ago at TSN, sure. And then Carolyn last night. So they're like jockeys. Like, they settle the panelists, the analysts down so we can perform better. But they were fantastic.
Absolutely. First of all, who stood out for you? I want to get into a couple of things here, and I want to get into Kevin Lowe as well. I got a couple of points and points of interest to share with you as well on Kevin Lowe. But what did you make of last night's game? The Maple Leafs beat the Philadelphia Flyers. Nylander with a pair. Jack Campbell with a shutout. How did you see yesterday's game?
Fantastic game from the Leafs, I thought. I mean, as I said last night, you have to be comfortable in close games, and good teams have an ability to win a low-scoring game, a 1-0 game. The offense can be a little fickle from time to time, but the defense is there for you night in and night out. Mm-hmm. It really is a choice that you take the defense. And when you absolutely have to win a hockey game, which I wouldn't say last night was in that category, but when you start the way Toronto started, you don't want it going the other way. So it really amps up the pressure on a game like last night. And they all, you know, they all, to a man, played very, very well, I thought. And really must have been a great feeling for the whole team leaving Philadelphia last night with that win.
Not an easy barn to win in, as you well know. And, you know, one of the more polarizing players, not just in Toronto, but it seems, Craig, around the entire NHL, is William Nylander. And front and center yesterday with a pair of goals. What are your thoughts on this player? I mean, there are many, he has many detractors, he has many supporters. Where is Craig McTavish on William Nylander?
Big supporter. That talent level is really, really elite. And, you know, you have to have all shapes and sizes on your team, and it really gets to the makeup of your team. And if you have players like Mitch Marner and Willie Nylander that are so talented, you know, maybe you've got to offset them with a little bit more grit, which I think they've done with Nick Richie and Wayne Simmons, fill that bill. But mm-hmm. those guys are special players. And, you know, there can be a pretty negative narrative around here if they're not winning, and it normally falls on the shoulders of those guys. Yeah. Because the production goes down, but they're special players. And, you know, I love watching those types of players play. They see and make plays at such an elite level, it's worth the price of admission.
You know, there's an old saying, cows don't make ham. You know, like, William Nylander is going to be the player that William Nylander is. Marner is going to be same. Matthews is going to be same, et cetera. Go right down the list, and I think you're bang on the money. When you say that everybody has a different thing they can contribute to the game, we haven't seen the perfect hockey player yet at any position. But is there one thing, I just want to ask you one more thing about Nylander, is there one thing that Craig McTavish, who's been in the game forever, is there one thing, Craig, that you see in Nylander that stands out more than anything else?
Just the skill level. The stick skill level. I mean, he's so quick with his hands. He sees the ice well. I don't think he sees it as well as Mitch, but he sees it pretty well. Mm-hmm. And they complement each other really well. I think the one thing that, you know, sometimes skill takes some time to learn is, you know, when to try and force a play in. and when to be content to make a simple play, and playing, it's gamesmanship. And those guys, I see improvements in their level of thinking and gamesmanship that they have. And, you know, the tough loss last year against Montreal, that's going to go a long way to motivate them to play the game the right way. And your decision making has to change with the situation in the game, as you know. I mean, sure, the score, the time, you're not making the same decision all the time. And those things, I mean, that takes time to develop those skills. But I can see both those players, Mitch and Willie Nylander, starting to understand the game and playing the game to win more.
With Craig McTavish from the NHL on Sportsnet. Craig, I'm going to go on a little bit of fishing trip here with you. I'm going to see if I can try to drag something out of you here.
Sure.
I was always told that when you were running the Oilers, one of the players you really wanted to bring in to Edmonton was Wayne Simmonds, as we're talking about the Toronto Maple Leafs here. How accurate was that? Because I kept hearing, oh, Mac T wants Wayne Simmonds on this squad.
I think everybody wanted Wayne Simmonds at that time. I mean, he just, our team at that time, too, you talk about the Leafs. I mean, we had a lot of grit when I was a coach there and a lot of character. And maybe took some of that, probably did take a lot of that for granted, that the character was just a given. And over time, I learned that it wasn't, and really recognized, again, the importance of you know, your bottom six players and the role that they play and the influence they have on your hockey team. And certainly Wayne Simmonds would be a guy that would fit that bill in that era. And he's still doing a pretty good job now with Toronto, but that type of hard-nosed player that goes to the net, you know, it sounds like a simple concept, but it's difficult to get players that aren't comfortable doing it to do it. And it really is. Like, it sounds simple. Get to the net. That's where all the goals are scored. You know, I remember one year as a coach, we put a pin in a punch board every time a goal went in. Where'd it come from? And of course, they're all right around the crease area. So that's where they're scored. If you want to be a goal scorer, you've got to do things that goal scorers do, and that's get to those areas. I mean, you know, it's not natural. It seems easy, but it's hard to get players to get there. And then when they're there, it's a situation where, okay, they tell me I'm supposed to be here, but you're not really sure why you're there. And you lack the efficiency that a guy like Wayne Simmonds would have. And, you know, Zach Hyman's been unbelievable for Edmonton at the net front. Yep. He's got a real willingness to get there and an efficiency. Ryan Smith was unbelievable there. I mean, It is a real skill. It sounds like an easy skill, but it's not.
You know, dovetailing that too, because you mentioned Wayne Simmonds, getting to the net is one thing, and you have to be tough and you have to be fearless to get there in the first place. Specifically, you know, not that long ago when, you know, you were coaching that Edmonton squad that went to the Stanley Cup final. Getting there is one thing, and then you're right, knowing what to do. You know, one of the things, and we'll throw a player like, you know, Joe Pavelski, Anders Lee into this conversation as well. One of the things about Simmonds is he's just so good at tipping pucks. Like when he gets there, I don't know, you've seen plenty of hockey players. Where do you rank Wayne Simmonds amongst the great players at tipping pucks in front?
Well, you know, to get the body position on the goalie and then deflect it. I mean, Ryan Smith to me was as good as there was. Holmstrom in Detroit was unbelievable. Remember him? He was fantastic at the net.
Oh, yeah.
He was as good as anybody. But they work at it. And you have to fight the battle. It doesn't matter. You don't have to fight the battle if the puck's not on his way to the net. But you have to have a sense of anticipation when you're there of when the puck's going to get to the net. And you can kind of go soft in the battle, but when that thing goes back to the point and it looks like it's coming to the net, you have to push off the opposition, free up your hands and your arms so you can get your stick on the puck. And those guys really instinctively do that, but it's a tough skill to teach.
with Craig McTavish. And Craig, when you ran the Oilers, we all know you were big on blocking shots. We all remember the tennis ball practices and get out there, boys, and we're dropping down. And that's become now something that's gone from, wow, look at Craig Ludwig. Look how crazy he is with those big shin pads. He's, you know, ridiculous enough to get in front of shots. Now it's expected sort of everybody. I mean, you want to excuse some superstars from doing it for the obvious reasons. But do you find that that's now an expected part of everybody's game in the NHL?
I think so. I think the technique has changed over time. There aren't too many guys that leave their feet anymore. Mm-hmm. I like the defensemen, you know, it was up to them whether they thought they needed to leave their feet, but I like them to have the ability, and I'd like them to have the tactic in the toolbox that they could go down. Because then the goalie can pick the puck up coming over top of you. And but I think for wingers, you have to be able to stop that puck from getting to the net. If your point coverage has the puck on the blue line, if you're going out there, you've got to be in a position where that puck can't get through you to the net. If it goes through you to the net, then I think you haven't done your job. If it goes around you off the side of the net, then you've done your job, but you have to protect pucks going to the net.
Did you expect all of your players to do that?
Well, the other thing, Jeff, is it's a brace of grit part of the game that guys can add that aren't necessarily of that nature. And if, you know, I look at a guy like Jared Stoll, I mean, when I had him, he didn't really know how to block a shot, but he learned. And, I mean, it's pretty fearless of a guy going down. I remember there were lots of instances where Stoley would make courageous blocks, and it really added to what he brought to the team. And it's a way for guys that aren't hitters or real physical guys to add a bit of grit to their game. I think it's valuable.
Bench loves it, eh? Like right up and down the bench on a big block shot. Like there are a few things that give you that charge like that.
Yeah, in Europe it was they start banging their sticks against the bench whenever a shot is blocked. You know, it's just it's a pretty fearless thing to do. And I always used to use Jason Smith, who played for us, who was
good defenseman.
As tough as they come.
Yeah.
He would put his face in front of a shot if he thought it would help. And I used to say, do you guys really think that the puck hurts Jason Smith any less than it does you guys? And, you know, but he was just fearless. His feet were pretty banged up, but the guy was just fearless. But I mean, that's what it takes to win at times, you know, like even Hall last night had a few really big blocks in the third period, which was, you know, I think important for him and his confidence. And it made a lot of it helped the Leafs solidify the shutout.
I want to get back to the NHL here, but I want to make sure we park some time by talking about Kevin Lowe, who goes into the Hockey Hall of Fame on Monday. It was really nice to see number four go to the rafters. Really enjoyed that. You know, one of the things that I always wondered about, and I didn't think that it would be an issue for Kevin Lowe, but anyone that followed those Oilers teams, that dynasty squad, looked at it and said, hold on a second, this doesn't look right. This Taylor or Hall kid wearing number four, that's Kevin Lowe's number. Was that ever an issue in Edmonton when Hall first started?
Well, not for Kevin. And he was the guy running the organization at the time. He insisted on it. It was his rule that he put in place that, you know, to have your number retired, you had to be elected to the Hockey Hall of Fame. So Kevin put that rule in so it would stop any consideration of retiring his number. And I don't know that he ever felt he was going to get into the Hockey Hall of Fame. I don't even think he cared. He was, I mean, as he said before, obviously now it's a tremendous honor for him and a thrill for him and his family. But as he said before, you know, I was happy with my career. You know, I was happy the way my career went. I guess you would be when you win six Stanley Cups, Jeff.
Sure. Yeah, that's that's a lot of rings. You know, the interesting thing about Kevin Lowe, and I like the fact that he's going in for a number of reasons. One, I like the person, and two, I like that style of player. And when we think about that Oilers squad, we tend to defer to, you know, the obvious, you know, Wayne and Messier and Curry and Coffey, et cetera, Grant Fuhr. And these are all headline players. These are all, you know, some of the elites around, you know, in the history of the NHL. I've got a real soft spot in my heart for the defensive defenseman. And I always find that that is an area that is undervalued by the Hall of Fame. Sure, there's, you know, the Leo Boivins in there and the Rod Langways in there. Personally, I could probably make a case for Adam Foote as far as being a defensive defenseman. You could make a case for. I just like, Craig, that there is a defensive defenseman going in the Hall of Fame, the one area that I think is really underrepresented in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Agree or disagree?
Totally agree. It's a very tough, it's a tough end to measure. I mean, the offensive end is much more measurable statistically, as you know.
Yep.
And as Jacques Lemaire, I was at a coaching clinic at one of the drafts, and part of it was I got hooked up with Jacques Lemaire, and we went from room to room, and there were all these minor hockey coaches and semi-pro hockey coaches. And so it was a real thrill for me to hook up with Jacques Lemaire. And he went in there, and all these coaches, there was like seven or eight coaches in this room, and they were just in awe waiting to hear what he had to say. And his message was really simple. Like he said, you know, one thing you guys have to remember in the game of hockey is there are two nets, and they're both equally important. And it was just, you know, brilliant. And he's exactly right. And that's why he had such a great career as a player and as coach. And Kevin was fantastic in the other end. And he was a pretty good offensive player coming out of junior. But when he got to Edmonton, obviously Paul Coffey had that position filled, you know, effectively. And Kevin knew that, you know, how he could add to the performance level and the dimension of the team was to take care of the other end, and he did for many, many years.
Sneaky but, tough too, hey? Like when we think of Edmonton and we'll think of, you know, Dave Semenko for one, or Kevin McClellan and Don Jackson, like there's some really tough players on that team, but Lowe was pretty sneaky tough, wasn't he, Craig?
Yeah. He'd fight you to the death every time, every night. And he was always ready for it. And he had a rare quality that a lot of the greats have, that they had an ability just to elevate their game slightly at the most critical moments of the game or the season and just be that much better. But yeah, he was good. He was very good and very appreciated by everybody in the organization. He connected with everybody in the organization, all the trainers and, you know, the management and the coaching staff and the players. He had a connection that I think is unparalleled from what I've seen.
What do you make of this year's edition of the Oilers? I mean, a lot of it's headlined by Connor McDavid, and we're still talking about that Rangers goal from last Friday, and we're going to be talking about it for a long time. But what do you make of this year's edition?
Oh, fantastic team to watch. I mean, much like Toronto, they're going to have to make some improvements in their team play, but they're getting to that point where they're really coachable in that regard, and they're really interested. Okay, we've done this. We've got all the personal accomplishments, trophies, and so forth. How do we play the game to win a championship? And I think that's where they're at right now, and I think they're dangerous. They're really dangerous. They added Kenny Holland, added a bunch of guys this year that have really helped. Duncan Keith, Zach Hyman, Fogle, all those guys have been great, really good additions. CeCe's played really good. I know Leaf fans know him well, but he's played well. And, you know, I always thought the knock against him was the five-star blunder at a bad time, but he's been super solid. With with Duncan Keith. Those two have been excellent. He's been a great addition as well.
You know, he was – it seemed as if there was about maybe a quarter of the way into last season when Todd Reirden, assistant coach of the Pittsburgh Penguins, really almost turned Cody Ceci into a pet project of his and really helped turn his game around. Like last season in Pittsburgh, it was a revelation. Like, I think everybody in Ottawa and Toronto kind of went, well, where was this guy? You know, he really had a turnaround season, and a lot of it, you know, I think you can listen. The players got to do the work at the end of the day, but I think a lot of it is, you know, and assistant coaches don't necessarily get, you know, the praise that they deserve. But Cody Ceci's performance last year, I could draw a straight line between Cody Ceci and Todd Reirden and say it's that relationship that turned that player's performance around.
I think that's a great observation. Coaches can have an amazing impact, especially on defensemen. And I would say the same was true with Darnell Nurse and Jimmy Playfair. I don't know that, but like you, I can draw the line from Jimmy Playfair's arrival there and Darnell Nurse's emergence as a really good player. And it's just it's how you frame the game from a defensive standpoint. It you know, and how you explain it to the player and coach the player and how it resonates with the player. And, you know, the coaching can have a really great effect on especially defensemen.
You know, we've talked a couple of different times here in this chat, Craig, about defensemen, whether it's Kevin Lowe or right now just Cody Ceci. I am curious, as someone that's been in the game as long as you have, how do you evaluate defensemen? To me, it's the toughest position to get a handle on. I mean, listen, if you just make it simple, you just say, well, you measure a defenseman like this. Puck goes in, puck goes out. That's what a defenseman's supposed to do. But it is deeper than that. Craig McTavish, how do you evaluate, how do you measure defensemen?
Well, I measure all players based on two criteria, what you give up and what you make. And the gap between those two things is where your value lies. And defensemen, you know, you can evaluate defensemen different ways. They have to move the puck. You have to make plays. And, you know, and you know, you want the middle. You want those clean plays in the middle. You need those. You need to turn back and reboot the offense. You don't want to continually slam the puck up the wall. I mean, that's an effective play when it's your last play. But, you know, you've got to make plays. And, you know, some guys are great defenders. Other guys are great puck movers. As we talked about before, you seldom get it all in this game. But it really is the difference in what you give up and what you make.
I want to ask you kind of a goofy question to finish up here. You were the last player in the history of the NHL to go without a helmet. Right now, visors, as we all know, are mandatory. You join the league, you're wearing a visor. I've always thought maybe the answer to this is Ryan O'Reilly, but I'm not sure if you've even thought about it for a second, Craig, but here I go. Who do you think will be the Craig McTavish of visors? Do you have a thought on who might be the last guy to go visorless in the NHL?
Oh, haven't thought of it at all.
No one's ever asked you that question?
No. Nobody's ever asked me that question. But you look at the timeline, because when I came in 1979, that was the year it was grandfathered, that if you were in prior to that year, then you weren't obliged to wear a helmet, and that's the year I got there. So, I mean, that speaks for itself, and the same will be true, I would imagine, with the visor. What year was that mandated? Do you know?
I think, was it 3-4 years ago? No. Hang on. No, wait a minute. No, this would have been like maybe 2014. I want to say that they were mandated at that point.
I'd look at players that came into the league just prior to that and how good they are.
You know, I always think back to a line by Bobby Orr, when there was a time where, and the Boston Bruins were sort of all helmetless, and then Bill Masterton, that tragedy happened, and everybody started to put on helmets. And even the Boston Bruins at practice, and it was really rare, like, whoa, all these Boston, including Bobby Orr. And I think he wore it for like half a practice and then ditched it and just couldn't wear it, couldn't get used to it. And was asked after, I guess some reporter was saving this question up, Craig, and said, trying to be cute with Bobby, said, Bobby, work with me here. I don't understand something. He said, you wear a jock, but you don't wear a helmet. Can you please explain? And Bobby spun around quickly and said, well, the answer is easy. I can always get someone else to do my thinking for me. Which I thought was a pretty clever answer.
That's a great line.
On the spot.
That's a great question and a great response.
Listen, sure. This has been a lot of fun. Great seeing you on television last night. Fantastic work. I look forward to seeing you around the shop. Thanks so much for stopping by today and spending a lot of time with us here this afternoon. Much appreciated, Craig. You be well.
Anytime, Jeff. Thanks.
There he is, Craig McTavish, now from the NHL on Sportsnet. The last player to go helmetless in the National Hockey League, a player, a GM, a coach, has been around and done a lot, if not all, in the National Hockey League. We're going to step away and want to get into a story here that is nowhere close to being over. The Dallas Stars right now, and we touched on this a little bit yesterday, the Dallas Stars lost last night to the Nashville Predators. The Dallas Stars have a stretch now where they're going to play a bunch of games at home. Last night was one of them, and ultimately they couldn't win, couldn't come up with any points in that game. There was a players-only meeting afterwards. There was a very brief, like under 30 seconds, press conference with Rick Bowness, the head coach of the Dallas Stars. There is no video or audio available of it, but we'll read the transcript in a second. The Dallas Stars are now under 500. They are the oldest team in the league. I don't want to say that the bottom has fallen out of the Dallas Stars, because that's not true. But what is true is the Dallas Stars are the only team in the NHL without a single win in regulation. All their wins have come in either overtime or by way of the shootout. What's happening in Dallas, and what is next? And are you ready for a 29-second press conference from the head coach, Rick Bowness? We'll read the transcript in a couple of minutes. As the Merrick Show continues across the Sportsnet Radio Network, we're talking Stars in a moment. Welcome back to the program. Merrick Show on the air across the Sportsnet Radio Network. Thanks so much for joining me today. Thanks to Craig McTavish for stopping by here in the first hour of the second hour, or first part of the second hour, rather. Wanted to turn our attention quickly here to the Dallas Stars before we bring our producer, Matt Marchese, here on the program. Dallas Stars right now, fifth in the Central. Dropped 1-4-2 last night at the hands of the Nashville Predators. Dallas is in a tough spot right now. I mentioned that they can't seem to win in regulation, the only team in the NHL that does not have a regulation win. Yes, Arizona does have one. They've beaten Seattle. 4-6-2 for 10 points after 12 games at that has a winning percentage of 417. Goal differential is -12. They've lost two games in a row. They'll play a number of games at home now. Nashville yesterday, Philadelphia on the horizon, Detroit as well. Quick trip to Minnesota, and then they're back for St. Louis and Edmonton on the 20th and 23rd. But this is a team that's had a hard time manufacturing offense, had a hard time getting production from some of the high-paid talent on this team. The line they found last season, which was magical for them, Jason Robertson, Roope Hintz, and Joe Pavelski, haven't played up to last season's standards. Again, I know it's early. It's 12 games in for the Dallas Stars. But when you start to hear press conferences like this, as there is a players-only meeting going on after a 4-2 loss at the hands of the Nashville Predators, you do wonder. So this is Rick Bowness, head coach of the Dallas Stars, okay? This is last night. This is his very brief media meeting. Okay, Rick Bonus shows up and says, shoot. Saad Youssef, by the way, provides the transcript. Question. Is a team meeting like that significant? Rick Bonus. We'll find out. Question. What's the message in that kind of meeting? Bonus. We'll find out. I know exactly what's wrong with this team and we're going to fix. Question. What do you need to fix? Bonus. They'll know. Question. Are you in that meeting? Bonus. No. It's players only. So we'll fix it. I know exactly what's wrong. We'll fix it. See you tomorrow. That whole media exchange took a cozy 29 seconds after the 4-2 loss at the hands of the Preds yesterday. Anybody else get the feeling something's going on in Dallas right now? Anybody get the feeling that there could be some changes on the horizon for this team if things don't turn around as soon as maybe the game 2 days from now against the Philadelphia Flyers? Here's the one thing we know about Jim Nill, their general manager. Jim Nill is a very proud general manager. Jim Nill was part of that leadership cradle in Detroit that included, you know, Ken Holland and Steve Yzerman. Jim Nill's a big part of it. There were a lot of teams that tried to remove Jim Nill from the Detroit Red Wings and have them run their team. But it never happened until Dallas. Jim Nill is also a really loyal guy. Jim Nill in his personal life is a very loyal person. Jim Nill in his professional life is a very loyal person as well. He's loyal. Everybody who follows hockey knows that he met the Jim Montgomery situation with a lot of disappointment. Right? You remember that press conference? And he wore a lot of it himself. Even still, right to the very end, he was still trying to protect Jim Montgomery and not reveal too much out of loyalty both to Jim and his family as well. Jim Montgomery has since come out and explained what happened, but it didn't come from Jim Nill. That's not the kind of person he is. So if you're in a situation like this, I guess it does test your loyalty, both to your players, perhaps to your coach as well. And the question you always ask yourself in a situation like this, what Dallas is going through with some underperforming players and a coach that clearly seems frustrated and unable, at least at this point, to fix anything, is the issue one of composition or is it one of coaching? This is the oldest team in the NHL, but this is a team that is not that far removed. Hello, bubble. From appearing in the Stanley Cup final. Last year was an awful year for Dallas. Last season was an awful season for Dallas. Whether it was injuries coming off the Stanley Cup final in the bubble, hello Tyler Seguin, or whether it was natural disasters in Texas, whether it was a significant COVID-19 situation. The Dallas Stars, for me, last season were the one team that I looked at and said, I give this team a mulligan. This is an underperforming team right now, and we all know why. It was going to be a challenging season for everybody last year. We all knew that. The Dallas Stars specifically were the one team that were hammered by everything around them. And so I looked at last season and said, I'm not going to make up my mind about Dallas based on what we saw because there were just too many roadblocks in front of them. But they've come out of the gate quite mediocre and unable to win in regulation. They're having a tough time scoring 5-on-5. And you look at someone like Jamie Benn, who at times in flashes reminds us of that once dominant player. But 2 goals in 12 games, 5 points in 12 games, that's tough. No one is in double digits now in points on this team outside of Miro Heiskanen. which this next version of the Dallas Stars, we all know, will be built around. And we all know there is that Miro Heiskanen line as well for defenders, that Jim Neal is not going to go above 8.4 or 8.5 by way of salary. I think he still wants John Klingberg on this team, but not at the $8.5 million mark. So what happens now with the Dallas Stars? What happens if they drop the next two? They lose to Philadelphia and they lose to Detroit. And Detroit has stung some teams, most recently the Edmonton Oilers. Don't sleep on the Detroit Red Wings. They're not the most skilled, talented team in the NHL right now, but that's a team that you don't sleep on. That's a team that can surprise you, that has guns that can surprise you, that can score. And a really good young defenseman by the name of Mo Sider, who's really starting to turn heads. So I'm not sure what happens with Dallas here. But last night, players only meeting, 29-second press conference, something's going on in Dallas. Doesn't sound very good. Is the general manager ready to do something about it, is the question. So you bring in Matty Marchese, our producer here. You have a thought on Dallas? Matty, they're one of my, I always park it when the Dallas Stars are on my TV and make sure I watch at least a couple of periods of every game. And I'm still stunned, as we were talking about yesterday, that Denis Gurianov hasn't really popped yet. I'd like to see more from that top line. I'm curious what's happened to Jamie Benn's game. I love watching John Klingberg. What's not to like about Miro Heiskanen? But this is an old team, and it's an old underperforming team, and that's a bad combination. What do you think, Matty?
Well, when you say you park time for the Dallas Stars, I feel like you're a glutton for punishment, Jeff. To watch that.
I like their uniforms. I think there should be more green in the NHL.
Oh, I made that point before. Green ice, green.
Yeah, I just
boards.
Like watching green on my screen. I don't know.
Green fans. Everybody's an alien. So this Dallas team, if you look at their roster, I know plus minus is not the be all end all. I understand that. But when all of like three players are a plus, or all of three players are a minus, there's a real problem here. Tyler Seguin leads the team in goals with four. And that's when you look at this team, I don't know. It just doesn't really move the needle for me. They have some talented players, but has Denis Gurianov hasn't been able to put it together. Like you mentioned, Roope Hintz has one goal this season, Jeff, after such a great year last year. Roope Hintz has done basically nothing on offense. And then you look at, you know, Jason Robertson, who had a really good rookie season, albeit he's only played six games and has 5 points.
He was injured to start. He was dinged up. Yeah.
So there's a you know, an adjustment period for him coming back from injury. But then you look at the guys that they've brought in. Ryan Suter is not young. They brought in Joel Pavelski a couple of years ago. He's not young. Jamie Benn is not getting any younger, and neither is Tyler Seguin. So it's not a young team. And when you look at the talent levels outside of Miro Heiskanen, and do you look at any of those players and go, those are elite talents? I understand that Rick Bowness is coaching a certain way, but I feel like with this team he doesn't have a choice but to coach that way, because he doesn't have the horses on offense like some of these other teams do, especially in the Central Division. So I think that's part of the problem here, is he has to coach. He's coaching to what he has and not what he doesn't. I understand that Rick Bowness is a defensive coach, but this is the team in front of him, and it's not an elite hockey team. It really isn't outside of Miro Heiskanen.
See, I can see Jim Neal doing something, like right now, doing something minor. I don't think they're in a position right now where Jim Neal is necessarily going to do something major right away, or he's going to do something big to jolt the system here. But I can see Jim Neal doing something. That's just the way it feels right now, that this team is close to doing something. What that something is, I don't know. But I can't see this going on. I can't see, you know, there's a couple of days here between games. You know, they don't play the Philadelphia Flyers until the 13th. I wonder if something minor happens with the Dallas Stars. We'll see. It's a curious situation. You have anything else on the Dallas Stars?
Not particular. Just I just wonder what that move is. If it's a minor move, like I do wonder, I'm sure that there are teams that knock down the door for a guy like Dennis Guriano, but I do wonder if maybe there's a situation where they look at another team with, you know, another younger player that's struggling and they just flip them and just say, hey, fresh start for both guys. Let's see if we can jolt the system here. I do wonder if that's something that's in play.
Or high profile scratch.
Yeah.
I mean, Rick Bowen was pretty hot.
Yeah, no kidding. 29-second press conference. He was so hot they didn't even want to get the audio out to anyone. That's how hot he was. So, I mean, yeah.
Dallas did not want to put that one out.
No, they didn't. No, I can, for a look behind the scenes here, for those listening, Jeff called me before the show and said, can you get me that audio? And I went, okay, no problem. It's there. And I'm looking around for it. And not there. Find it. So off we go. So if there's a high profile scratch again, okay, so maybe this gives these guys a jolt for a few games and say, hey, we got to get our butts in gear. But again, when I look down at this roster, I just don't see it. I just don't see this, like, forget long term. I don't even see it for this season unless guys like Hintz and Gurianov and even Radulov has one goal. I don't know. It's a really aging roster that just doesn't really appeal to me all that much.
Yeah, Radulov is the one. I mean, they've been trying to get Jamie Benn and Alexander Radulov going. Like, I don't have many doubts about Tyler Seguin. I don't have that many concerns about Tyler Seguin, even though he's only got the 7 points in 12 games. Right-hand shot center, I got a lot of time for Tyler Seguin. I don't know that he's playing with the right system that complements his skill set. That's more of a coaching issue, obviously. All right, let's park Dallas and move on. What else is spicing your chili today? What else do you want to get into?
So the two hottest teams in the NHL currently are the Los Angeles Kings and the Anaheim Ducks, who we've spoken about earlier today.
Yeah.
If you had to choose one of those teams' futures, who do you want? Because I don't even think it's close, personally.
Why? Who do you got?
I think it's Anaheim going away.
Why is that?
I love what they have, like, especially having John Gibson. We in the hockey world, John Gibson, I guess because he plays on the West Coast, is not talked about enough as one of the best goalies in the league. He's so good. And Jamie Drysdale, like the clip that we played coming into the block with Eric Stevens, like if you watch that overtime, Jamie Drysdale goes in on a breakaway, gets stopped, the puck goes up the ice, and Jamie Drysdale catches JT Miller at the other end of the ice at the end of a long shift. Like, his skating is incredible. I do like what they have up front. I look at LA and I don't have a lot of faith in Cal Peterson. Like, he's a good goalie, but he's not John Gibson.
Oh, I don't know. I like Cal Peterson, man.
But he's not John Gibson for me anyway.
No. He's not John Gibson. I think John Gibson is one of the best goaltenders in the NHL. But still, I do like Cal Peterson.
But if you had to choose of those two teams, I don't know. For me, it's Anaheim going away.
Yeah, Anaheim's real good. Like, and on the horizon, there's Mason McTavish, who's the third overall draft pick in the most recent draft from the Peterborough Petes. Troy Terry, only 24 years old, lighten it up. Trevor Zegras, that skill set is elite for his age. I like Isaac Lundestrom a lot as being a sort of mini, I don't want to say Bergeron because I always hate that comparison. He's just a really good two-way player. How about we leave it at that? Isaac Lundestrom, a former first-round pick as well, is a good two-way guy. I think there's still a lot for Max Comtois that he's going to give you. I think that Bo Grew has grown up, obviously, in a hockey environment. His dad, Benoit Grew, who's with Syracuse right now as an assistant, he's grown up in a hockey environment. There's a really good hockey player there. I mean, it's going to be curious to see what happens to them come trade deadline time, right? Because there's some decisions now to make if you're Jeff Solomon. What happens with Hampus Lindholm? His contract is set to expire at the end of the season. What do you do with Josh Manson, who's 30? His contract set to expire at the end of this season. So you have a couple of decisions there. This may sound like a weird one here, but what do you do with Nicholas Deslauriers? And the reason I bring that name up, specifically around the Metropolitan Division. You know, that's someone, Nicolas Deslauriers, who is considered to be one of the toughest players in the NHL. And as everybody is loaded up in the Metropolitan Division, whether it's, so we saw Zach MacEwen last night with the Philadelphia Flyers, whether it's Ryan Reeves with the New York Rangers, Ross Johnson with the New York Islanders, you know, scared to put him on waivers because someone's going to claim that guy, even though you're not going to play him, you just got to keep him around in case you need a nuclear deterrent. Like that, we talked to this with Keith Jones 2 days ago, that there's some old school in the Metropolitan. Nick Deslauriers, I didn't even mention Tom Wilson with the Washington Capitals. That's a really tough division, and everybody, you know, wants to make sure that they're well armed should games turn that way. I would have a hard time believing that the Pittsburgh Penguins haven't tried to get Nicolas Deslauriers away from the Anaheim Ducks. Like, I know teams have called about him before, and the price is always really high. And listen, if you're going to get rid of Nicolas Deslauriers and he's that coveted around the NHL, you ask for a high price. But he's a UFA at season's end. I wonder what happens there, because if he hits the market, I would imagine that the Pittsburgh Penguins would have interest in that player and someone like him. Like, I like Anaheim. I like the Anaheim Ducks. I like Dallas Eakins. I think he's a wonderful coach. I just wonder about how much a complete season of inactivity from the general manager has done to this team, Matty. Like, let me ask you this. Is there one team in the NHL who did less this offseason than the Anaheim Ducks? Like, nope. They flirted with Jack Eichel. Okay, maybe Kamir go away. And ultimately, obviously, he didn't go to Anaheim. But that was it. Anaheim didn't do anything this offseason. And you're always curious, you know, how much is a complete offseason of inactivity set an organization back? Now, you might just say, listen, the Anaheim Ducks are just in, you know, make sure the kids improve, make sure Mason McTavish and Lundestrom and Zegras and Drysdale are in a good environment and they have the right veterans around them, and then that's it. If you feel you have that, then just leave it and well enough is alone. I just wonder how much the inactivity by Bob Murray in the offseason sets his team back. I don't know the answer to that. We'll find out one day. But that's what's one of my big questions here for the Anaheim Ducks. As far as the Los Angeles Kings go, I thought they'd be able to score based on some of the players they brought in, most notably, and he's injured now, most notably Victor Arvidsson, who I thought had a rough last couple of seasons with Anaheim, but the fresh new look with LA, I thought that would really help. I thought bringing in Philip Deneau would allow Anssi Kopitar to be more of an offensive player, and it has, 15 points in 13 games, Deneau shouldering more of the defensive checking role as he's used to. We thought we'd see some younger players pop. We thought we'd see some guys like Alex Iafallo start to pop. He has. Adrian Kempe, the speedster, to start to find his game. That's really happened. The questions I have about LA are on the defense, are on the blue line. And without Doughty, without Walker, how long can they keep doing this? And how long can Jonathan Quick keep playing this way? You know, Jonathan Quick is 35 years old. 35-year-old goaltenders that play like Jonathan Quick shouldn't be playing like Jonathan Quick right now, Matty.
Yep,
like, he's
correct.
Playing at a 924 clip. That's insane for Jonathan Quick, isn't it? As we go off air here, give me your quick little nickel and dime thought on LA. That's my nickel and dime on the Kings.
That's what I would have said. Is the defensive unit is where my concerns would lie. Like, Cal Peterson's fine in net, and I don't mind their forwards. But yeah, after Drew Doughty, I mean, and Drew Doughty's he's 32 years old, so he's not young anymore either.
He's not. Okay, Maddie Marchese, our producer. Thanks as always for putting the show together. Thanks to Lance Kennedy, who's playing keyboards back at Master Control. Thanks to Mike Kelly for kicking off the show today, along with, we should mention, Ian Mendez, who updated us, speaking of LA, on the Ottawa situation. The Sens play the Kings tonight. 8 players out of the lineup on COVID-19 protocol for the Sens. Eric Stevens of The Athletic, Craig McTavish of the NHL on Sportsnet. Listen, thanks so much for joining us. Merrick Show returns tomorrow, same time.